Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast, episode 118. I'm Tom Merritt. And that's Brian Dunaway.
He's not Scott Johnson.
Scott Johnson had to be called away. Actually, we'll reveal in a moment. We have too many Scotts if we have Scott Johnson. So Brian Dunaway filling in for him today.
Right. And I couldn't be happier to be here. I can't wait to see this battle to death between Dana and Scott. And who's going to get it right?
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for filling in for Scott. Our guest today, you heard a tease already, Scott McNulty, author, podcaster, and regular on The Incomparable on the 5x5 Network. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you for having me. I hope I survive.
I hope you make it. May the odds be ever in your favor. I it was going to be kind of tedious to be going, well, Scott Johnson, well, Scott McNulty, now we can just say Scott, and it's much easier. Also joining us, Dana Wallman, Senior Reviews Editor at Engadget. Good to see you again.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Thanks for coming on Forecast. We got some predicting to do. Let's get right to it. Our first one comes from a listener. Chris wrote in and said, we have our MakerBots that create cool things, but where's the MakerBot for creating awesome food? Download Rachel Ray's dish you just saw on her show. Click OK on your TV to buy the dish you just saw in that P.F. Chang's commercial and have your chef bot create it from raw materials that you plug into your machine like cartridges. Let's get our world-class chefs on iTunes and let me subscribe to their weekly dish in the exact way they would prepare it, no exceptions. Your machine will already have your allergies and dislikes programmed into it to ignore certain ingredients if required. I make this distinction from a replicator because I feel like my chef bot might actually happen.
That is scary. That's a good way to get fat. I mean, if I ate everything on TV that I saw, oh my God, it'd be terrible.
Well, it's bad enough when they give the phone number for ordering delivery, but right. To just hit print?
Yeah, just hit print and have that thing come out. Actually, this is a great idea. I love the idea about having your allergies already built in, so you don't have to worry about that. And I love the idea of anything materializing out of thin air. That's a fantastic idea. Of course, he's talking about putting, you know, trash or garbage, I suppose, in like you would see in Back to the Future. But, yeah, I like this idea. It's a fantastic idea.
Well, that's the thing. If it works like MakerBot, you're going to have all the ingredients available necessary. Right. And you're going to have to – there's going to have to be a lot of nozzles.
It would be nice if instead of just ordering the recipe you want, if you could tell what recipes you have or what ingredients you have just sitting around in your fridge that are maybe on the verge of getting stale, and then it can, you know, tell you or make something involving mushrooms.
Like a genius feature.
I mean, that's what I would love is excuse me, find a way to get rid of the stuff in my fridge that I don't really have an intelligent or creative way to use, and I don't want to waste it. But I feel like even then you would need to do a little bit of legwork getting the ingredients you want, right? Because otherwise you have a lot of overhead refrigerating and keeping everything fresh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unless there was some kind of sludge that it was magically turning into.
some kind of protein paste.
That's what I have in my refrigerator now. It's nothing but a bunch of sludge. I don't know.
Well, see, he's saying I like this over a replicator because it might happen because we actually have 3D printers. But the materials are kind of the hang-up, aren't they? Like, how do you have the materials you need without having huge overhead?
Right, or having the lowest common denominator be ingredients that you can't pronounce, you know?
Or powdered milk. And, you know, because it's hard to keep milk fresh. And then, you know, your maker bot runs out of milk. I guess you could order it.
That would be horrible. You could always go for the astronaut type philosophy, and we could just recycle everything. Just have one hose going out of your house from you know where, and just come back into your refrigerator.
Scott, how does that appeal to you?
That is not so appealing. That's not the image of the astronauts that I want to have in my mind. But yeah, and I my question is, what happens if it jams? I don't know if I want to be the one that cleans it up.
I really want to make a toast joke there somehow. If you get, you know, you're gonna have to keep those nozzles clean.
Oh, yes.
Which is good advice in life. Anyway.
That's true, awesome. Actually. Always keep your nozzles clean, kids. Remember that. All right, let's move on to the main predicting. But don't forget, if you're like Chris, you can send us your predictions. Our email address is forecastpodcast@gmail.com or post them up on our blog, forecastpodcast.com. We have forecast@twit.tv working now, too, as well.
Right.
Send them along. All right, the predictions can come from anywhere you want, any area of expertise or not. Just your wild vision of the future doesn't matter. Dana, we'll start with you. What's your prediction?
I predict that the term ultrabook is going to become so diluted and meaningless that it's not going to be useful to companies anymore, which is to say, I think most computers are going to be ultrabooks and there's going to be very little differentiating factor between them and other so-called laptops anymore.
So we'll just call, we'll call everything an ultrabook.
I think you're already seeing that. I think you're seeing, these large screened notebooks that really just look like regular notebooks that are being called ultrabooks are not necessarily that much more portable than what used to be called, a thin and light. And I think you're going to see companies coming out with strange names for things that are kind of like ultrabooks, but maybe don't technically meet Intel's requirements, but everyone still wants to jump on the ultrabook bandwagon and have that sort of, sexy, slim appeal. I think the term's going to be totally meaningless by the end of the year.
An ultrabook is, like you mentioned, defined by Intel. So you're not allowed to market your laptop as an ultrabook unless you meet their specs. But there are clever ways to get around that, I would guess, right?
Totally, yeah. I mean, without revealing anything I know, actually about company strategies, I do think you're going to see companies coming up with creative names that signal it's supposed to be an ultrabook, even if it technically doesn't meet the specifications. And I think Intel's own specifications are wide enough that it allows for 15-inch machines to be called ultrabooks in the first place, even if it means they're not necessarily super slim machines, but they're just thin for a 15-inch machine. So I think Intel's own requirements sort of allow for that kind of dilution.
Brian, do you see yourself calling all laptops ultrabooks soon?
I don't see why not. I mean, laptop really doesn't fit as much as it used to. I mean, so many people don't put the laptops on their lap much anymore. It's almost a portable desktop. So, yeah, I can totally see this transforming to using ultrabook for everything. Why not? It sounds cool, too. It sounds futuristic, ultrabook. I like it.
I think it could also become meaningless because people just don't use the name at all.
No, they don't. Again, they really don't.
That's another possibility. Scott, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think that, quote unquote, normal people use the term ultrabook now. So I think we're living in this ultrabookless future already where it's meaningless. I think they're just computers, right? And that's what people are going to call them. Call me crazy. That's what I think.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, Dana, though. It's sort of like the Intel is really pushing this as a category, as a thing, and they want people to pick it up. And so I think it ends up being one of two ways. Either it becomes meaningless like 4G, where people are like, I don't even know what that means. All laptops look the same. So that's an ultrabook, sure. Then it's an ultrabook. Or do you think it just doesn't catch on at all?
I think – I don't know how many normal people use the words, but I think you've got major – I see people like David Pogue who write for these mainstream audiences, not just, right. More geeky people like our Engadget readers. I see them using the word ultrabooks. I think that will help educate shoppers at least to the fact that there is this word. Now, will it convince them to buy, let's say, an $800 notebook when there are $400 ones available at Walmart? I don't know. I mean, I think ultrabooks will catch on maybe if they were more affordable and easier for people to buy. I think part of the problem is they're slightly aspirational for a lot of the people Intel and other companies are going after right now.
What do you think about this is sort of in the ultrabook vein, although not technically an ultrabook. The rumor today from Digitimes that Apple would come out with a $799 MacBook Air because they'd get a discount on Ivy Bridge, theoretically, and they'd be able to put out a really cheap, thin and light, essentially ultrabook. Mac would never use that. Apple would never use that term.
I wouldn't be concerned about the discounts on Ivy Bridge. I would wonder where they're getting their discounted solid state drives. I think that's one of the limiting factors right now that separates, let's say, the $700 and $800 ultrabooks from the $1,000 models. If you see a $700 ultrabook, the trade-off is almost always that it has a spinning hard drive, maybe with some flash memory attached to it. But that's what I'd be curious about. How much access to solid state drives does Apple have, especially from suppliers like, I don't know, Samsung? Mm-hmm. That's what I would wonder.
Tim Cook's kind of a genius at that stuff, but even he can't just make it appear out of thin air for nothing. Scott, do you actually think of laptops in the terms of Ultrabook? Do you like thin and light laptops? Or what are you in the market for? What do you see yourself using?
Well, I do have a PowerBook. Not a PowerBook. What am I, from a time traveler? I
have you have an iBook. Is that what you're
saying? I'm like, what am I? I don't know what I'm doing.
You have a Compaq?
I do. I have a MacBook Pro, 15-inch, okay. Right? And so I do have MacBook Air envy when I see some other people who have MacBook Air. So I think that it, as a form factor, it's very compelling. But I am a large, clumsy person, and I often wonder if I will bend my Ultrabook, or whatever you call them, in half. So that's kind of a concern for me.
Brian, you're laughing. Is that something you worry about too?
I always worry about bending something and breaking it in half. But yeah, I thought the same thing when the iPad came out. I'm like, oh, this is too fragile. I'll crash. I'll just crack it for sure. As far as the MacBook Air goes, opposed to the Mac that I have, I want to be jealous, but I've played with them enough times that I will break them. I do break them. I have broken them. Keyboard broken. Did it.
But so you break them anyway.
I'll break them anyway. You're right.
Doesn't matter whether it's an Ultra.
Doesn't matter if it's Ultra, if it's Air, if it's whatever. Doesn't matter. I'm going to break it.
So, Dana, do you have an inkling of what would come after Ultrabook? If your prediction turns out true and it just becomes genericized and tells, like, crap, we need something new.
I mean, this isn't even me looking into a crystal ball. I think there's definitely a lot of companies signaling that they're going to make laptop and tablet hybrids. Probably more on the side of laptops, more Ultrabooks with touchscreens, I think, is a better way of describing them. But that's not even me being some sort of genius with foresight. I think there's a lot of indication that those machines are coming, and they're coming later this year once Windows 8 arrives on the scene.
Right. We already have the Transformer Prime, right? So there's a little trailblazing happen.
Mm-hmm. Trailblazing happening. And, you know, you've seen things like this from Lenovo, among other companies. The only company that's pointedly not doing it is Apple, just, you know, based on remarks that, you know, Tim Cook made recently and on an earnings call. You know, the fridge toaster thing.
Yeah, right. He's like, but that's Apple's way. They deny that anything is useful until they decide to make it. You know, they said that there's no reason to watch video on an iPod.
Right. And I mean, you know, if they have to make a bigger touchscreen iPhone soon bigger screen iPhone soon to respond to market demand, I'll be curious to see how they talk their way out of that one. Because for the longest time, they said that 3.7 inches was the perfect size. Be no longer.
Yeah. Usually what they do is they just deny, they sort of ignore that they ever said anything else and then just tell you how resolutionary it is.
Pretty much, yeah.
So if we have to, one last thing before we move on, if we have to coin a term for the hybrid tablet laptop that will be coming, I think you're absolutely right. What will be the nickname? Is it LapTab?
Laplet.
Laplet. Ooh, I like Laplet.
Tab top.
That's nice. Tab top.
Laplet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like kind of Laplet.
Touchbook.
Is a thing, or was a thing.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Dang. Always late.
LapTab, says Cheeto. He's voting. They're voting in the chat room.
Taplet. Yeah, I like that.
Dana, any...
You're saying Touchbook isn't an option, right?
Well, I mean, I guess we could call it a Touchbook, but that would... We have to hire some lawyers. Touchbook.
Right.
Only old people.
Like, I think they're going to be called hybrids, and people are going to know after a while what a hybrid is.
And then so they'll be ultra hybrids.
They'll probably end up calling everything an iPad, just like everybody does in our society. It's just like they'll boil it down. My mom will call it an iPad. Why? Because you touch it, and that's what she knows. Everything's going to be an iPad.
I think it'll be hybrid for a while, but I still have a feeling that some clever journalist will coin a phrase out there.
Oh, yeah.
Hybripad. I don't know. I mean, look, netbook and ultrabook. The
netbook was a horrible name.
Forget that. iPad itself was a horrible name. We've gotten used to
this
it.
This is true.
All right, Dana, any other predictions before we move on?
You know, I think a lot about how much people are going to watch TV on the iPad, or, you know, not just the iPad, tablets, and whether or not that will catch on. That's something I'm not actually sure of. It's something I wonder about a lot, but I can't honestly say if that's going to find its way. It seems like it's been attempted before, but hasn't really found a large audience, or it hasn't been that successful from a business perspective. You know, curious to hear what other people think.
Yeah, why do you think it's been so difficult to catch on?
I think it's just people are, you know, companies are so protective over their content. I think these deals are very hard to ink in the first place. And then it's a question of what kind of variety of channels can you get that would make it worth paying a premium for watching TV on this separate device when you might already have Netflix and you might already have a subscription to Hulu. You might already have a TV with a cable box. How much content can you squeeze onto the tablet before it until it becomes worth it?
What do you think, Brian?
It's an interesting topic, and I don't know. It's moving so fast right now. I went to look at Blu-ray players the day just so I'd have a second one in my bedroom, and everything is built in now. It was ridiculous for me to even think about buying a Roku player when they have everything built into the Blu-ray for like another $20. And I use my iPad all the time to watch Netflix movies for FilmSack. I love all the streaming stuff on the iPads and everything else. Stream it.
I think it's a niche. It won't replace the television per se, but it becomes another option. What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the cable companies are working on this whole TV everywhere.
TV almost anywhere.
Right.
Exactly. As long as you pay us.
TV somewhere.
Appear.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that so now with these tablet apps and all the cable companies are coming out with special applications that you can watch. Some companies even have where you can watch live TV on your iPad as like a value add to your cable subscription. I think that that's where it's going, at least for the time being, because content providers need to get paid. And Netflix's economic model is a little shaky because, as we all know, you go on for Netflix streaming, you're not going to find a lot of first run movies. Why? Because it's just so darn expensive.
Yeah, what you're seeing is Netflix and Hulu and even YouTube getting into creating original content, so that there's a value add to the back catalog that they also have available. And I would keep my eye on Aereo, which is a New York company that wants to sell you a subscription to over-the-air content that could be delivered in an app form. They're getting sued, obviously.
I was about to say, yeah, that's
But they have a very good case that what they're doing is saying, look, all we're doing is taking free over-the-air channels on an individual antenna and right. hooking them on essentially the equivalent of an extension cord to someone and charging them for the privilege.
Right.
And they have a technology that provisions an individual miniature antenna to every single subscriber. So they're not rebroadcasting. They're just sharing. They're just sending the signal.
Oh, they're going
to
shut those. They're going
to
shut those guys down. They'll find
a way.
I don't
know if that's so clear that they will.
There's been so many years, individuals have been fighting the fact that, hey, DirecTV is beaming a signal into my backyard. If I have something that can decode it and I can watch it, tough noogies.
Yeah, but these are not encrypted signals. That's the key. This is a free over-the-air signal that if you put an antenna up, you're able to get. And all Aereo is saying is, we're doing the same thing Cablevision did, and they won in court. Cablevision said, we're taking the signal that we have the right to receive, and we're going to operate the DVR remotely and send it down the line. The court said, that's fine. As long as you have one machine for every subscriber, that's okay. And so Aereo's like, we're going to do the same thing, but instead of just the DVR, we've got an antenna.
The difference between Cablevision and Aereo is Cablevision pays retransmission fees, right? So they're paying the broadcasters for the right to get it, these channels, even though they are free over the air, right?
But the law is that they don't have to pay retransmission fees.
The law will be changed.
And Aereo has said they're willing to pay retransmission fees.
Mm-hmm. We'll see if you do.
So yeah, I don't know. I think you guys are right. Like they're definitely going to have to fight for it. But
oh yeah,
I don't know, Dana. What do you think? Do they have a shot?
It sounds like it. It sounds like they also did a lot of research before launching the service. I think I read somewhere that they tabled more than one idea before they landed on the business model that they finally chose. So I think they will have to fight for it, but I think that they've researched this carefully. And I don't think they're just being cavalier when they say, you know, we shouldn't be sued or we'll win a court fight. I think they really did research this and very carefully pick their loopholes before launching this product. That's the sense I get anyway.
Yeah, they're backed by Barry Diller, who, if you're not familiar with the name, he's one of the guys that started Fox. He's been around the business for a while, and he runs a company called IAC, which does a lot of interactive content, so he knows the web as well. So if anybody can figure this out, it'd be a guy like Barry Diller, I would guess.
Great. They're going to turn all the TV off now. No more free-to-air TV.
They're just going to say no more broadcasts. Forget it. All right. Let's move over to you, Mr. McNulty, and find out what you've got in your crystal ball for us.
All right. Well, so from ultrabooks to just plain old books, anyone who knows me knows that I'm an avid reader, and I'm also kind of obsessed with e-readers in that I own every version of Kindle that Amazon has produced, and I've purchased every version of Nook. Why do I own all of these? I don't know, because I have too much money, apparently. But so the big thing in publishing industry is afraid of e-books because they think that physical books will somehow magically go away. And my prediction is that in 500 years from now, people will still be reading and purchasing physical books. I think that they are not going to go away. They may change, but they're not going to go away. I think that most people will read in 500 years' time, or even 50 years from now, will read most of their books and get most of their books electronically. But I think that there still will be a big market for physical books, right. Both used books, because there are millions and millions and hundreds of millions of books in print that are just not going to disappear. And I know that I buy a lot of used books, even from Amazon.com. They make it super easy to buy used books. So you can pay like $2 instead of $8 for the Kindle version. And so that's my bold prediction. And plus, you know, I did a little research because that's the kind of guy I am. And the oldest book in Europe was recently bought by the British Library. Does anyone have a guess at how old that book was?
Was it a Gutenberg Bible? Oh, no, the oldest book, not the oldest printed, like, typeset book. Oh, wow. I don't know. Anybody else want to take a stab?
Ooh, scary to even think. 1,000, 1,200, 2,000.
1,300 years old.
Wow.
It's the St. Cuthbert Gospel, which was sealed in St. Cuthbert's coffin, and they found it later. So it's perfectly preserved. And I don't think that my Kindle is going to last in the year 3000. I don't think people are going to find my Kindle and find all of my books on there.
Right.
You know, it was an interesting, I was reading on Dan Simmons, the author Dan Simmons site, the other day, and he was talking about how paper is necessary because it's a good, stable way of storing information. As we constantly are changing formats and the kinds of machines that read digital media, you know, he thinks we need to stick with paper because paper, well, it can burn and it can molder and everything. Everybody can read it easily if you can keep it in existence. So it's an interesting conundrum on that, and just that part of your prediction alone is copying and translating digital files, which we have endless capacity to do, better in a situation where you've got archive.orgs of the world sort of saying, hey, we'll take everything and make it accessible and make sure it's readable. Or should we be backing up hard copies on paper?
But it depends on how serious you are about your backups, right?
Yeah, right.
Because, well, let's think about it. You have a WordPerfect 2.0 document from whatever, how long.
Which I do, actually, well, on this hard drive. See, and I can't open it in anything.
That's my point.
Yeah.
But if you have a book from 1,300 years ago, you can open it and read it just as you could the day it was printed. Which is
now,
you
know, I can download a conversion piece of software that will take that and make it into a readable format that I could then use in OpenOffice or text editor or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't have to do that with the 1,300-year-old book. I may not be able to read the language it's written in, but I'll be able
you
to look at
it. You just need a software upgrade on yourself.
Yeah, right. The language. Exactly. Brian, what do you think of the future of paper books?
I'm going to go with Scott on this because of the simple fact of you can't impress anyone with your Kindle or anything else by putting it on a shelf. You can impress people by when they come over and see the many books you have on your shelves. And aesthetically, spines might as well get a whole book. You might as well just go ahead and do it.
They'll notice.
Because
they'll
somebody picks that up and you leave them with a spine, oh, you're not going to hear the end of that, man. You're not going to get rid of that at all. But I definitely think a decline of production will really come into play because people like me, I don't know how many other people are out there like this, but I love old books and I used to love going to the library, but my allergies to dust is so intense as I get older that I can't even open an old book with all the mold and everything else that gets in old books without just getting sick for days. And I'll tell you that electronic books have changed my world. I read old stuff that I haven't read in forever because of that. I'm with Scott. I don't think books themselves in print is going anywhere. I think it'll definitely slow down. But I don't think it's getting anywhere.
It sounds like both of you think there's a place for both. There's a place for ebooks. There's a place for printed books. Dana, do you agree?
Oh, I definitely think there's a place for both. And I think, you know, as tech journalists, it can be so easy to overestimate how techified the rest of the country is and the rest of the world is. But I don't mean this as a dig against AOL, my parent company, but there are still people out there who are buying dial-up service. And there are people who don't have smartphones. And there are people who don't have access to 3G, let alone 4G. And there are people who still buy desktop computers. You could still buy a VHS player if you wanted to. So, I mean, with all that in mind, I don't see how books could be going anywhere anytime soon. I mean, who knows what it's going to be like 500 years in the future, but for the very, very foreseeable future, I don't see how books could possibly become extinct. I think the market will slow down. I think publishers, you know, may have to lay off people. I think they'll have to be more careful and selective about what books they publish. But I don't see why they would disappear, especially anytime soon.
Yeah, it's funny how fast things change, huh?
Incredible. And I'll tell you, Dana, you can support any of those people who don't have a smartphone for just the cost of a cup of coffee. You just send it to them through PayPal. No, I don't know.
No, I was going to say, it's funny how fast things change where you're right. For a long time, you feel like, oh, I'm probably overestimating how many people have tablets or how many people use the internet. And then overnight, suddenly, Facebook is a really good example of this in the recent few years where you're like, oh, Facebook, it's kind of that weird social network. It just opened up, mostly college people, not that many people know about it. And then it seemed like overnight I was getting friend requests from old high school friends and my parents and just, it was everybody was latched onto it. And now everybody's on Facebook. If you're on the internet, you're on it pretty much on Facebook. So there'll be that point, but I think you're right, Dana. We're not at that point yet where people are so technologically habituated, for lack of a better word, that they'll just stop buying paper books. Now, when we will get to that point, right? I mean, electricity used to be something that not everybody had. It was sort of optional. Now, if you don't have electricity, it's considered to be either a lifestyle choice or some sort of horrible situation, at least in the United States, that needs to be rectified. I think we'll get that way with internet and with gadgets, and the prices will come down. I mean, the price of a Kindle, the cheapest Kindle is what? With the advertising one, it's like $59, I think? It's,
$79.
No, you're right, $79. So it's fairly inexpensive. When we get to that point, that's past what Dana was talking about, and maybe that's 50 years from now, right, or even longer. Then, when everybody has access to an e-reader and everybody has access to a ubiquitous internet with no data caps, the ability to download as many books as they want and the publishing industry has figured it all out and they're charging reasonable prices, do we still have books then, Scott?
Yes, we do.
And why is that?
Well, I think that they will. At that point, they'll obviously become a niche, right? But there are, to my point, as a civilization, we've built giant buildings that are just full of books, right? The Library of Congress has something like 35 million books in it. And even in 50 years when everyone has an always-on internet connection, those books aren't going anywhere. And there are going to be millions and millions of books that just won't be available electronically. So you'll need to get the physical copy, unless Google wins.
Google will have, yeah, they'll have scanned them all in by then.
Their scanning, shredding machines will deal with that.
They've eaten the libraries.
Exactly. So I think the book will change and it will become a niche, but I still think that people will be publishing them, and certainly a smaller and smaller segment of people will be buying new printed books. But I think that they will continue. And machines like, I think it's the Espresso or something, that's an on-demand book printer that you can go into a bookstore and, you know, pick a book that you want and it will print the book for you there. Stuff like that will happen where you'll get more on-demand stuff for people who want physical books.
Lunacode, I think, brought up a really good point in our chat room. He says people still like vinyl. Everybody thought vinyl albums were dead. There's the CD, and then there was digital music on top of that with the Napster revolution, MP3s. Why would anyone want vinyl? And it turns out vinyl did decline quite precipitously, but then leveled out because there were very good reasons why people wanted vinyl. They liked the sound of vinyl, or they wanted to DJ with vinyl and not digitally and not with a couple of iPods hooked up. And it became a choice, and it became something that had particular advantages that were discounted, you know, when CDs came along. But I think we do find values in older forms that maybe we didn't think were that valuable at the time because we took them for granted. But when we move on to a new form, suddenly it becomes apparent why, well, wait a minute, I can read this book without having with it when there is no electricity. I can read this book on takeoff and landing. I don't have to shut it off. You know, we start to realize what those advantages are. And go ahead, Brian.
I agree with you. And I think there's a certain amount of not only nostalgia, but there's a warmth that you find in vinyl that you can't find anything digitally. Like someone said in the chat room, they asked about Laserdisc. No one really uses Laserdisc. And that market is totally out at this point, except for, like, I don't know what, some biology classes or something maybe still uses them. But as far as the warmth of it and that feeling, there's something classic and just the soul warming about records and books. Also, books are totally would give that feeling that I just don't think you can get from a lot of cold things that you see now. I mean, like, once the DVD goes away, I'm not going to miss the DVD. There's not going to be any nostalgic period in my life where I go, ooh, the DVD. Well, I just don't think it'll be there. But there's a very warm, soul-warming thing about books.
Actually, I think the DVD will stick around. Not the DVD, but the optical storage will stick around.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we'll want, whether it's Blu-rays or whether it's some future optical storage that allows for a larger capacity, we'll want that externalized object. And I think that's one of the reasons books will stick around, too. We want to collect things. We want to have the first edition of Game of Thrones. We want to have the definitive collection of both series Lost with the action figure and the printout manual that has exclusive pictures, and we like collecting things. Now, those won't sell in the great numbers that cheap paperbacks do now.
Right.
But there is sort of this idea of historicity that we like to attach to things. I mean, first editions, I've used this example in other discussions about this. First editions are no different than the second edition in most cases, except they have the word first edition printed, and they were printed first. But we value that. We're like, no, but that was the first one out of the factory. And so I think that is one of those things that will make us want to continue to have those forms. But why is it, do you think, that Laserdiscs and 8-tracks and probably VHS do just fade away and we don't use them anymore?
I think the main driving point behind Laserdisc was that the quality was so much greater than anything before. And then it was usurped by something that was greater technologically. Whereas books don't necessarily fit in technology like we think of it. It's more of a, like I said, it's something that's just unattainable. It's books. It doesn't have anything to do with technology per se. You could say, yeah, but that was a huge technological advance way back when. But I think there's there's just something organic about it.
Anything else, Scott, to add before we move on from that?
I love books. That's really all I have to say.
I love books.
I love books.
I'm a big fan. I will buy ebooks so that I have the convenience of being able to read them on the device I already have with me without having to carry anything extra, and then I'll go buy the hardback because I want to.
I love both ebooks and books. So yeah. I love them all.
All right, it is time to move on to four questions. This is the segment where we ask each of our guests to face four questions about the future. We ask them not to stop and think, just answer from the gut, sort of a free association sort of thing. And Brian, you will be asking four questions of Scott.
Absolutely, Scott. Remember, do not think about these questions. I didn't think about when I wrote them, so don't think about the answers. Are you ready?
No thinking is happening right now, so don't worry.
Totally clear. Assuming bionics, biology, and electronics become affordable for the everyday man, woman, child, what bionic human parts do you predict will be the most popular and why?
Oh, I bet eyes, so that people like us won't have to wear these glasses, and you can you won't need binoculars, right? And I'm colorblind, so they can fix that too.
Nice.
Maybe X-ray vision. Who knows? I want to get rid of my eyes.
It was my favorite part of the $6 million man doll was looking through the little bionic eye thing.
Right. See, right. You can see straight through his little crystal eye there. It was awesome. Loved it. All right, ready for the next question?
Yes.
If we encounter an alien life form, what is the most likely product Apple will try to sell to them?
Something with DRM on it, probably. or nothing that they can open, obviously. It's all hermetically sealed, so it's the perfect thing right to give to an alien. They won't be able to figure out how it works. I assume iPads. That's what they're pushing now, so iPads for everybody.
So easy. Right. Even an alien can use it.
So no difference. It's like, yeah, whatever. How big are your hands again? All right, whatever, E.T. Here, get this thing. It's perfect for you. Touch
We've added 12-point touch just for you.
But I don't have hands. Who cares? Use it.
That's right. All right, Scott, one more. Two more. How will our eating habits evolve over the next 100 years?
We will, if American society is any trend, we will eat and eat more. And we will end up like Wall-E and have our little hover chairs and cupcakes in a cup.
Nice.
Which I could go for right now, actually.
Sounds pretty tasty, actually.
All right. I know you're a reader. I know you got to love science fiction. What science fiction technology do you think would be a horrible idea to develop in the real world, and why?
That is a good question. Probably the transporter. Because then my mom would just show up at any time, and I'd be like, hey, Mom, thanks for coming again
thanks.
For the fourth time today.
Great to see you. And putting a guard on the transporter.
That is a problem with the transporter that people don't discuss often enough. How do you keep people out of your house if they can just beam in?
Constant drop-in. Everybody. All the time.
Everybody's right. Going to have force fields erected at all times.
Right. Yeah, put like a Stargate, that Stargate gate closer thing they got. Close them right up.
The iris?
Like a bug. Yeah. Smashes like a bug around that thing. Boom.
Because otherwise, you just get traveling salespeople beaming into your house like, hey, you got a moment? I see you're cooking dinner.
That's right.
I've got a great
if it's supported by Google, there'd be AdWords all over it, too. So it'd just be crazy.
No, you're right. No transporter. Okay, Dana, your turn for four questions. Are you sitting comfortably?
Yes.
Good. Then we'll begin. Question number one. What will it take to drive us to spend as much exploring the ocean as we do space?
I think we'd need to be really short on oil. And I think that finding the really, really deep sea oil would have to be cheaper and faster than getting it the way we normally get it. But I think it's going to be economically and oil driven, probably, and less by curiosity.
Yeah, why is that? Why are we less curious about the depths of the ocean, which are just as unfathomable as the deeps of space, and easier to get to?
Easier to get to, and they're definitely unfathomable. I think the ocean, it is, at the end of the day, just another layer, because we already have sort of a concrete, no pun intended, but we have a fairly tangible idea of what's underneath the ocean and beyond. I think there's something much more romantic about the idea of space. And it's really hard to wrap your mind around the idea of space and something that's infinitely expanding and isn't necessarily contained by anything else. So you wonder what's outside space. I probably sound really trippy talking about it now, but it's hard for me to explain or understand.
I think you hit on it. Even if we can't explore just the barest little bit of it that's nearby our planet, the idea that it goes on forever is different than the ocean, which we know has a bottom. I guess that's it. I'd like to see us explore more of the ocean, though. Question number two. If extraterrestrials arrive not to conquer us, but merely looking for affordable housing, what should we do? Sort of halfway between the normal conquering alien race.
Are a bit screwed, don't you think?
And District 9. Do we District 9 them? Say, you know what? Sorry.
District 9 them?
Yeah. The movie District 9 just rounded up all the aliens and put them in an encampment.
Unfortunately, I can see that happening. I mean, or else we're going to have some homeless aliens. But, you know, I don't think we know how to really handle affordable housing. And by we, I kind of mean the city of New York. I don't know if I can speak for the whole,
sure,
you know, planet of humans. But even New York, to name one example, doesn't know how to handle affordable housing that well for human beings. So I think those aliens are going to be quite out of luck.
We'll just turn down their credit, I think.
And then turn down their credit?
Yeah, and then they'll just have to go away. Oh, I'm sorry, you weren't approved for the mortgage. Afraid. And you don't have any references. You don't have any references for your rental agreement, so we can't approve it. All right, question number three. How will we do interplanetary MMOs when the lag is so bad? Like, I want to play with the guy I know who lives on Mars, but it's just such a lag between them. Will we ever be able to fix that?
No.
I was hoping for, like, you know, we'd just reverse the polarity and then it'll be...
Ooh, I like it.
Well, you're asking a former English major, but it would be nice if satellites could somehow be put to good use, but I'm not going to... I doubt that would work.
Quantum entanglement, maybe? I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's got to be something. No, but the thing is, you're probably right. There's probably just no way of
it. If there was such a thing as, like, spectrum, like the equivalent of spectrum, but, mm-hmm. you know, intergalactic, who would regulate that?
That actually is an interesting parallel to a book coming out this summer by Rob Reed called Year Zero, where it's not spectrum, but it turns out that the entire universe has been listening to our music without a license. And they now, under their own laws, they owe us the entire wealth of the universe in copyright infringement fees.
That's brilliant.
And so they come to destroy us because they don't want to pay the bill. And I think that could happen with spectrum. Like, we would get wiped out because they're like, actually, you're transmitting all of this stuff, television, radio. You don't have a license to do that. You haven't paid for the spectrum. It's interesting. Finally, question number four. How long will the laptop form factor survive?
Oh, I think for quite a while, at least. I mean, I don't think the tablets are going to kill devices with keyboards anytime soon. I think if they're going to kill anything, it would likely be most desktops, except for, you know, certain machines that are geared toward, I don't know, artistic professionals who use them in an office setting. But I think desktops are sort of the buffer that are going to get killed first or reduced first. And I think laptops might have a changing form factor. I think, like we saw, you know, we dove into netbooks and then out of netbooks, and now we have ultrabooks. I think the form factor might change a little bit, but I don't think laptops are going anywhere that soon.
100 years?
Oh, gosh, 100 years? We could be done with laptops by then. I mean, maybe we'll have more transformer-type machines. Well, especially if tablets are more powerful. I mean, we have smartphones today that are probably more powerful than, you know, early archaic computers. So I sort of shudder to think how powerful tablets are going to be one day. And I think there will come a time when you can't argue that they are underpowered or too underpowered to do what most people want to do.
There's some really good research being done, being able to recognize the shape of your mouth. And the reason that intrigues me is they can actually tell what you're saying without you having to vocalize it. So speech recognition is a nice trick, but I don't want to be walking around controlling my laptop and having to talk out loud. But if I can just mouth the words, and if it does some eyeball recognition and knows what part of the screen I'm looking at, and so I can move a cursor around that way, I think that would be brilliant.
Yeah. And I think you're going to see it. I mean, there's a company called Toby that was made a big splash at CES this year. They have this eye tracking interface that's going to work with Windows 8. And it's not perfect. You kind of still have to press your mouse button, even if you're tracking something with your eyes. But it's a start. And, you know, Samsung unveiled this new technology on the GS3 this week, which, you know, where you could keep the screen from timing out just by looking at it. I mean, that's really interesting. And I think if we can do that now, that's a really brilliant start, I think.
Did you play Asteroids at CES? That was one of the demo games Toby had.
I saw it played. I didn't get a chance to play it.
I didn't play it either. I think Sarah Lane played it, though. It was pretty fun. Or maybe it was Ayaz. I can't remember. But yeah, that's cool stuff. All right, well, that's 4 questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is the end of our show. Thank you both for joining us and sharing your viewpoints on the future. Really appreciate it. Brian Dunaway, thank you for filling in for Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Appreciate that as well. Scott McNulty is the author, the podcaster, and the regular guest on The Incomparable at 5x5. Which or all of those many things do you want to let folks know about, where they can find more about them?
Well, in keeping with my prediction, I think that people should just search for me on Amazon and then buy all of my books, both physical and ebooks.
Don't stop until you've collected all of them.
Exactly.
Scott McNulty.
And they're better when purchased in multiples.
McNulty. Take a search. And you can follow him on Twitter at blank baby. Dana Wallman, of course, senior reviews editor at Engadget, so we can find your stuff on Engadget. Anything else you want to tell folks about that's coming up particularly?
That's coming up. I am going to be doing a bunch of travel soon. I'm going to South Korea next week. I'm going to be reporting from Samsung's headquarters.
Oh, exciting.
And then early June, we're going to have Computex, which is going to be a really big tablet and laptop and ultrabook heavy show. So can't share any news from there, but there's going to be a lot of news coming out of there.
Yeah, Computex seems to be becoming more important every year.
I think so, yeah. And I mean, this is my first time, but I think I can speak for Engadget. I think Engadget seems to be sending more people this year. So maybe that's a trend. Maybe there's just more interest, and that's great because more people like me get to see Taipei for the first time. So awesome.
And you can follow Dana on Twitter at Dana Wallman. That's W-O-L-L-M-A-N, D-A-N-A, W-O-L-L-M-A-N. Brian Dunaway, you, of course, co-host Film Sack with Scott Johnson when he shows up.
I do indeed. And we have a great time. We review movies that we watch on Netflix, and we give our unique take on films that don't always hold up.
No, but that's fun to watch them anyway sometimes.
It is absolutely fun to watch. We just did Hard Target with Jean-Claude Van Damme this past week, John Woo's first film in America, and it was absolute blast. Should watch it.
Check it out, filmsack.com. And Scott Johnson will be back with us next time. Thanks for filling in, Brian. Really appreciate it. And thank you, folks, for watching.
You,
and we will see you next time. Follow us on the web at forecastpodcast.com or send us an email, forecast@twit.tv. We'll see you next time. 32 years away.